mixture of factorization.
Half Friedrich Gauss once said one of the most noble or honorable problems in mathematics is to factor large integers. But you know, all these strange machines that will never be built anyway, that are designed to factor 1024-bit RSA moduli. In this talk, I want to show you why it makes perfectly sense to design such machines. I want to talk about costs, not merely about the figures, but about what costs are and why this is an issue. So let's start about RSA factoring algorithms. I'll talk about the running times and what running times means. Then I make a short deviation to symmetric cryptography. I'll secure 128-bit. Then I'll touch the question if we shouldn't use RSA with much larger bit sizes. Then the question about the security of RSA is in fact a question about economy. And then I'll come back to the main question of the talk, what are the costs to break RSA? And how Moore's law comes to it, and I'll end up with some ideas how to use that marvelous hardware to design hardware cryptography like Shart. So RSA factoring in algorithms. There might be other ways to break RSA, but people didn't come up with any better idea than to take the modulus n, which is the product of two unknown large prime numbers, and try to factor this. Yesterday we've seen one algorithm is the number field sieve, that's the most important for us. Another one is the quadratic sieve, and if you want to understand the number field sieve, you should maybe have a first look at the quadratic sieve. Something better is the multiple polynomial quadratic sieve, MPQS, and yesterday we've also seen the elliptic curve method. The number field sieve is an awfully complicated, complex algorithm, and there are dozens, if not hundreds, of parameters that you can change, and nobody really knows how to choose these parameters. And in the number field sieve, there are tons of numbers which are smaller than the number you start with, but you need to factor these numbers. And to factor these numbers, you might use the MPQS or the elliptic curve method. The idea behind the sieving is you try to find enough certain congruences, modulo n, and then this you do within a sieving step, and then within a metric step, you try to solve a huge sparse system of linear equations. And this comes out of the sieving steps. You build up a matrix, and then you try to solve this. In the quadratic sieve, you start with one quadratic polynomial. With the MPQS, you use many quadratic polynomials. And in the number field sieve, you use polynomials of higher degree. So what are the running times of these algorithms? For the start, you define such a function, or rather a family of functions, that you consider it as n goes to infinity, n is the number you want to factor. You have a constant here, c, and then a parameter t. Parameter t is what is most important, and it usually varies between 1 and 0. Suppose it is 1, then this factor is log n, and this factor vanishes, so you have something exponential in the bit size of n. If the t is 0, then this factor vanishes, and you're left with this factor, so this is log log n, so it's something polynomial in the bit length of n. And the running times are some running times of the algorithms here. You see the smallest number t is for GNSF, or SNFS. So I would deduce that GNFS is the most suitable to factor arbitrary moduli. But maybe you want to look at finite places of this function. And to look at finite places, you first have to replace this. This means you should put in there a function which goes to 0 when n goes to infinity. What people usually do if they want to look at finite places of this function L, so to get an estimate or some comparison about the running times and security, is to choose this function near zero or identically zero. So you get something like this, and if you want to use something about the security of RSA, you say maybe if you have just a few bits, here you have 500 bits, and you add a few more bits, you gain more security compared to if you are already at 2,000 bits, and add the same amount of bits, you gain less security. That's because the slope of the tangent line is larger if you're here and if you're here. So I took this function and put this function identity 0 in there. But we're in fact talking about asymptotics here, and these asymptotics are not even proven. They're just heuristic asymptotics. And for example, there's a variant from Coppersmith of the GNFS, which has a better asymptotics than the regular GNFS. So probably you would deduce that you should use that one. But in practice, it doesn't work out. Probably the Coppersmith method only works very well when you are much larger bit sizes. Another thing is, until several years ago, you couldn't factor such large numbers and wasn't even sure whether GNFS or anti-GNFS would be better, even though the asymptotics of GNFS is better than the asymptotics of anti-GNFS. So now I want to insert another function than identically zero in there. Let's take that one. And if you try to make the same deductions, it comes out exactly the contrary of what I just said. Let's choose another function. Oh, and in the large scale, the two functions of course look the same because the asymptotics wins again. There I have RSA with 2 million bits, looks exactly the same. Only there, at the left-hand side, there's a small deviation. So let's take another function that goes to zero when n goes to infinity. Here, this factor makes the function go to zero when n goes to infinity. This number cancels out that number. This factor cancels out that factor. I'm merely left with what's inside the logarithm here. So this function at the beginning looks almost like the function n squared over 10,000. You can put almost any function in there. What's your favorite function? Maybe the sinus function? So would you like to deduce something about the security of RSA from this graph? But asymptotically, of course, it looks like the other function. When this function is identically zero, there's just some small deviation on the left-hand side. But what I want to tell you, asymptotic says nothing about the behavior of a function at a finite place. And what am I talking here about? Everybody knows that it's first-class calculus. But cryptographers tend to forget this, or rather, in former times, you had nothing more than the heuristic asymptotics to say something about the security of an algorithm. So now we have better methods to say something about the security, but the terminology remains. So when someone says that this algorithm is sub-exponential, so it's faster than the exponential algorithm, it's slightly something different than that people mean. And I want to cite Adi Shamir here, who said constants are important. So I don't only have to look at the asymptotics, but I have also to look at if an algorithm runs twice as fast as another or something, to say something about the security of an asymmetric algorithm. So if the asymmetric complexity does not help much to estimate the security of RSA, how secure is then RSA? We're still stuck with this question. So let's make a deviation to the symmetric world. Yesterday from Jan, we have seen that he was able to break desk with 56-bit for, say, $10,000 within a couple of days. That was a published result. Maybe there are unpublished results that can do it better, maybe for $1,000 within one day. But what about in 40 years? I want to have a better security margin. Maybe I should think, maybe there are people that are able to break desks for, or will be able to break desks for $1 within 1 second. So what would that mean for 128-bit? Here, I have my 56-bit from the desk cracking. I'm supposing a perfect symmetric algorithm that can only be broken by brute force. In 1 year, one here has approximately 2 to the 25 seconds. So I'm left with a factor 2 to the 47. So I need to spend about 100 trillion US dollars to break that 128-bit cipher within 1 year. So this is what I call safe. It's not an exact estimate, just an estimate from below. If you have a perfect symmetric algorithm, it looks pretty safe. Now, what's about RSA-1024? Some people say it has the security of 80-bit. Yesterday we saw ECC with 160-bit might be safer than RSA with 1024. So maybe it only has a security of 65-bit or something. Let's be optimistic and look at 80 bits. The same calculation would mean that we need at least 50 cents to break a perfect 80-bit symmetric cipher within a year. Can't deduce anything about from this estimate, of course. So this shows me first that we need much more sophisticated methods for saying something about the security of RSA. And second, that asymmetric crypto, as we use it today with these bit lengths, are much less secure than the symmetric bit length. So we run a little bit into trouble there with the security of asymmetric cryptography, so maybe we should just use larger bit sizes. If we have much larger bit sizes for RSA, we can do some sloppy estimates and being on the safe side, and it would fit much better to the security of the symmetric systems that we use. So why not using RSA with large bit sizes? Okay, we can do this in computers, of course. There's a lot of calculation power. The point that I want to make here is the point that already Christoph and Ingrid did. We need some trade-off between security and costs, because, for example, in cell phones, you can't really put a large, maybe not a large bit size of RSA in there. Or think about cameras, access control, sensor networks, sensors, or small devices. You need to make them not very expensive. Satellites need maybe a device that doesn't consume so much power. Cars, the car manufacturers can count with a send, and there are hundreds of devices that have to authenticate with each other. And maybe you want to place some new firmware in these components, and these got to be signed and verified. So the asymmetric crypto on there should be not too expensive, very cheap. And then you have chip cards and RFIDs. The German signature law now goes much higher than 1024-bit RSA to secure the signatures on chip size, the signatures on the chip cards. So in our FIDs, you can't even put asymmetric crypto. So the point I want to make, you have to choose some trade-off. So especially for cost and for small devices, the cost of a small device depends directly on the security, because a small device, if you use asymmetric cryptography, doesn't do much more than the RSA calculations. So you should better choose a small bit length there. Okay, so we can't really use, in most applications, a large bit size. So we have to look much closer at the security of RSA than we did with the crude estimates at the beginning. What are the costs to break RSA? In fact, this is a question about economy. For economical reasons, you can choose large bit sizes. And it is crucial to give a precise estimate for every single bit size on how secure it is in common application, because breaking the cipher can lead to great economical loss, and choosing a bit size which is too large would waste a lot of money. This is not only for RSA, this is just an example. It's true for all asymmetric ciphers. Let's make a thought experiment. Suppose you have $10 billion, and $10 billion would be enough to break RSA 1024 with PCs. What can you do with these $10 billion? The obvious strategy would be, you're an adversary, you don't care about laws or moral or anything. So you could buy these PCs for $10 billion if you were done. you could also do is use hack PCs on the internet. You can rent them, I guess, for $1 a day. And if you rent very many of them, you'll get probably a good discount, so you can cut your costs there. Another idea would be you write your own Trojan horse, and you capture many PCs on the internet and use their spare processing time to break RSA. There's a little problem about scalability. These computers that you hack have large memories, small memories, fast processors, slow processor. So it is difficult to manage all this. Much more homogeneous environment would be the Sony's PlayStation 3 that we heard about yesterday, with a very good processor for code breaking. Maybe not especially for RSA, but for many other things in code breaking. Suppose you write a cool game for Sony's PlayStation 3 that uses little resources, and in the meantime it starts seeding as a background. So maybe you can break RSA this way. The point I want to make is not that these strategies work, but since the your adversary can do anything whatever he wants, he might have more opportunities than just build one machine for $10 billion. Another thought experiment is RSA 1024 really more secure than RSA 900 bit? Of course, a machine that breaks RSA 900 bit would be much cheaper, but there are again two different strategies. You can build such a machine and break your RSA 900. But you can also do a refinancing strategy. Build a larger machine that can break 1024-bit, and you ask people to give you money because other people might be interested in breaking keys with 1024-bit. So you start breaking keys for other people, and when you have collected enough money to pay your debts, you can start to break the RSA 900 key. The drawback is that you'll get the break the RSA 900 only after several years. So I don't want to say that RSA 900 bit is more safe than RSA 1024 bit, but a key is less safe if it protects a greater value. And the value is not something that is absolute, but it depends on the adversary. So a key is less secure if it protects a greater value, and the value of the key is different for different attackers. So in the real world, you really want to have a product with lightweight cryptography, you should answer several questions like, what are the values to be protected? And is it enough to break one key, one root key for the adversary? Or does he break many keys? Like, if he breaks one root key, can he break into all cars of a certain brand, or just into one car? Then who are the potential attackers, and what would be their revenue? Will they attack the application, or do they have better opportunities? For example, my house is rather secure if it has medium security and not so much value. Then my neighbor's house has less security, but there's a lot more to steal. So the adversary would rather break into my neighbor's house than my house. So these are all questions that depend on the environment. And now I would like to stick to the question, what are the costs of breaking the key? So I have to define something there. What are the costs to break RSA? I have the assumption now the costs in this question mean the costs to build and run some kind of machine that breaks RSA, excluding development costs. There are a couple of questions you might ask here. The first question that comes into mind, what is the smallest RSA key length that cannot be broken? One way to find the answer would be to design a machine that can break that key length that can't be broken, which is just a bit too expensive to be built and optimal in terms of costs. So this machine by definition cannot be built. Another question, maybe a bit more precise or more interesting, what is the smallest key length that cannot be broken within 40 years? To find the answer, you should design a machine using future technology that can break the key length, and this machine should be just too expensive to be built and optimal in terms of costs. So maybe if these designs like Quill or other designs seem to be rather adventurous, such designs are needed to answer the fundamental question about the security of today's applications using RSA, because you can't increase the bit length, you are stuck with a smaller bit length. So some observations about the time-consuming parts of a code-breaking machine. So from the point of view of someone who doesn't know very much about hardware, so it was surprising for me, for example, that memory is rather expensive, but computation is rather cheap. Then if you have a problem that you can solve in a PC, but you would have to buy like a million PCs, you rather should put it in ASICs, because that is much cheaper. And you have to minimize the time error product of the ASICs. And then another effect is that communication is expensive. Think, for example, about the PlayStation 3. If you buy 300 of them, you have about the same computational power as the largest supercomputer in the world, which is the BlueJean. The BlueJean is still much, much better because you can't connect these PlayStations in a way that they communicate very fast. And this problem is solved in a very good way in the large supercomputer. So communication is expensive. You have to look at that. Proposal for a roadmap to design a machine that can do some time-consuming parts in the procedure to break RSA is first to find the best mathematical algorithm to factor in RSA modulus. Then you should create a rough design, maybe modular with the ASICs, to realize this algorithm. You should minimize your communication because that's expensive. You should use a lot of local computations because computations are not so expensive. You should minimize the use of memory, especially the fast access memory. So maybe you should collect large amounts of memory you need into single locations and put there some off-the-shelf RAM, because you will never be able to beat the market when you build RAM yourself. RAMs are dispensed in huge amounts, and these companies really build cheap RAM. The cheapest RAM would be off-the-shelf RAM. Then when you're finished with that, you have to go back and restart all of the games, because now you have new constraints, and you have to adapt your parameters, maybe twist your algorithm a little bit. And when you have done that, you have to refine your implementation and go through this all over and restart again and again and again. After some time, you'll end up with a decent machine, maybe. So hardware design in Moore's Law, how does Moore's Law come into play? Moore's Law says that the computing power doubles every 18 months. This has been valid since 40 years, and many times people said, well, we'll never last very longer. It will come to an end soon, but they've always been wrong. So will it last much longer? The hardware crackers will be 1,000 times cheaper in 15 years. So Moore's Law will affect the security of RSA or any other cryptographic algorithm very much. So if now I calculate a number like $10 billion to crack RSA 1024, maybe in 15 years it's only 10 million, and then it suddenly is insecure. And the designs like Twill or Sharp that seem to be adventurous after several years because of Moore's Law, they don't look as adventurous anymore. For example, in 2003, Twill was designed with a futuristic technology of 90 nanometers. Today this sounds outdated, at least. Next year, 65 nanometers is in use. Also for the Shark machine with $200 million, that would be much cheaper today. So after several years, all these estimates about the security of an algorithm will decay. So will there be 40 more years for Moore's Law? There are some limits for Moore's Law. Think about 4 nanometer technology. The silicon layer would be 10 atoms thick. It's thick. So if you want to dope this layer, the doping atoms, you can't control the position of the doping atoms. Well, this position will vary. So if you look at transistors that are supposed to have the same characteristic, they will behave very differently. You have no control about that. If you go further down, there are not enough atoms left in the silicon layer. Then another huge problem for computer industry is that larger chips have a smaller yield. A couple of years ago, when the 386 processor was built, the yield was 71%. That means they produced that ship, and they had to throw 29% of the production away because of faults in the production. After several years with a Pentium processor, this yield dropped to 9%, so they had to throw 91% of the previous processes away. Now imagine how it would be with a Pentium 4 today. The yield, the production yield of processes, is a big secret of the industry, so we don't know what the yield is now. But if you have designs with large chips, it could definitely affect you, the design. And another big problem for Moore's law is the procedure, the production of heat in these chips. Today we're at about 100 watt per square centimeter, and you can do cooling maybe until 200 watt per square centimeter. For several years, nobody had an idea how to better cool a chip than 200 watt per square centimeter. Except, I think 2 months ago, in the IBM Zurich Research Laboratory, they came up with an idea how to cool even 370 watt per square centimeter. They use some kind of vascular system. They pump in water in here, and then it goes through smaller and smaller channels until it hits the chip surface. Then it goes up again, and the water comes out. And under research laboratory conditions, they managed to cool down 370 watts per square centimeter. You have the canals again. Water comes here, then it goes to smaller and smaller channels. And here it's very tiny. The water hits the chip, and then it gets up, pumped up again. But this is just a small step. It won't help to push the end of Moore's law much further, just a little bit. So my impression is that Moore's law will prevail longer than many people think. It will come to an end, probably in my lifetime. So how to use this wonderful hardware for at least performing the seeding step of RSA 2024 factorization of the GNSS. I recall the GNSS is it consists of several steps. Steve will talk more about this, but the most consuming, the most expensive steps are the seeding step, where you collect relations, where you build up your matrix, and then the matrix step, which solves this matrix. Yeah, the actual record with GNSS was is now 663 bit. That is in software, and for co-factorization, people used MTGS, not ECM. Maybe in hardware, you should rather use ECM. Shark is a design for a machine that performs not all the steps, but just the seeding step for the factorization of of a 1024-bit RSA modulus in GNSS. It should be finished within 1 year. Some costly properties of GNSS are GNSS is huge, so you can't really fit it on one wafer, not even on 600 or something. You shouldn't build a large ASIC, but you should somehow modularize this and put this in smaller ASICs. If you would try to produce large chip, it would lead to a dramatic drop in your yield. Second problem is GNSS needs a tremendous amount of memory. You shouldn't build the memory yourself because you will never beat the large companies that produce RAM, so maybe you should use off-the-shelf RAM. Then GNSS needs a lot of sorting data and communication, so you have to solve this problem in a clever way. So some ideas for the Shark machine to solve these problems. First of all, you should use small chips and divide your problem into smaller pieces that can be solved by smaller chips. For example, here you have chips that are maybe the size of a Pentium or smaller, and they're working about the large primes in the factor base. This part works for about the medium primes. This of the small primes, it's a little bit like what we saw yesterday. This chip performs the seeding, and then it sends its result to the ECM machine. The first idea is to split up the algorithm and localize the computation in several parts. And then about the memory, you should do this partition of the problem in a way such that it respects your memory needs. So you can equip every processor with its own memory, and you don't have to have connections between this processor and this memory or something. So you have to respect in your partition the memory needs. And the next thing is you should respect in your partition of the problem also the communication needs, because communication is expensive. Here you have just some small buses. There's really no problem. The only problem is maybe here in the butterfly sorting system, the processes that do some sieving about, do some calculations about the large primes in the factor base, produce some results, and this has to be sent to the correct part of the machine. So how it's solved here is that this whole construction is just one way, as all the other larger buses also. So the bottom part does not need to communicate with the upper part. These machines just produce a lot of data and send it through the system. You don't need a large speed to do this. You just have to have a large throughput. So the third idea was to respect the communication needs, and the main problem should be solved by a butterfly transport system. And the peak throughput would be like 1 gigabyte per second, and average 0.2 gigabytes per second. This is feasible. Here you see 8 slots. This is just for the shark machine, you need 1024 slots. So we spoke to people, and some said, well, 1024 is just no problem. And we had to choose some number, either 1024 or 2048 or 512. So we chose 1024. Then some people said it might be a considerable problem. So what I can say here, at least you have a problem about scalability. If you want to use the shark machine to, say, do the seeding step for 2048 bit numbers, probably your butterfly transport system should be larger, should be wider. And maybe this is not realizable anymore. So the point is here, for every single bit length, if you want to find the optimal machine, the optimal design, you can't use the same design every time. For every bit length, you have to design a new machine. But here for the shark machine, I think the 1024 lines are not so much of an issue. If you realize that you can't really build it, then you can also use 256 lines. And by that, if you change the parameters a bit, you probably will less than double your costs. And if 256 is also too wide, maybe use 64, and you will get another factor of 2 in the costs. So as a conclusion, the safety margin for asymmetric cryptography in today's products is small. You can do it much wider because asymmetric cryptography is too expensive. So economy badly needs an accurate estimation about the safety margin. So an accurate estimation about the costs to break the asymmetric cipher for every single use bit length. So you have to design a lot of machines. We haven't seen enough designs yet. So these estimates can only be achieved by creating and analyzing designs for hardware crackers. And to do these designs, this analysis needs mathematics, hardware engineering, economical facts, and a lot of common sense to bring everything together. Thank you.